You are listening to Radio Albion.
Everyone, welcome to the first edition of the Orthodox Nationalist for the new year 2024. I hope you had an excellent Santa Christmas, as we used to call it, and are looking forward to the liturgical Christmas on the night of the 6th. As you might be able to hear, I'm sick, but that doesn't stop me from doing anything like this. I remember back in 2014-15, when I went through this grinding divorce, I remember waking up Christmas morning to absolutely nobody, which is a very interesting experience if you know what I'm talking about. But roughly around that time is when I began asking for donations because I was absolutely bankrupt. And they came in a flood, at least at first. And I don't think you guys who donated back then, are you same thing donating now, know what that did for me under those circumstances. It wasn't just keeping me financially functional. It kept me psychologically functional. And I don't want you to underestimate the significance of that, especially over time. And I remember one of these I did for the Voice of Reason in 2009, somewhere around there, was on the Ukraine, the Ukrainian collapse into the Third World. You know, I keep using that old terminology, first, second, third, and fourth world. It's not fashionable anymore, but it does make a certain amount of sense. So I'm going to start off 2024 with also, you know, an incredibly seminal, pivotal year, and that's 2014. We're talking about almost exactly a decade ago. We're talking about what happened concerning the so-called Orange Revolution in Ukraine, the first one 2004, the second one 2014. The latter was far more violent. What happened in 2022 and the war and all the sanctions came directly, the war especially, from the defeat of the Ukrainian military in mid-2014. The president who was overthrown early that year was Viktor Yanukovych. Now, I remember writing a paper on him, how he thought politically and to attach that to his policies, the collapse of the country, and I lost it. It was on an older computer. I couldn't find it. But just the other day, I saw it was actually on an old email address as an attachment. It was written in 2015, the summer of 2015, and I went over it. I'm going to publish this on my Patreon account, and it's impressive, if you don't mind me saying so, that how everything that was condemned by the media then is accepted by far more people today. No one has... You know, Viktor Yanukovych is very wooden. He looks like, you know, the stereotypical Soviet bureaucrat. He even has the hair and very non-charismatic. part of that, of course, he does come from that bureaucratic apparatus, and men in that era, let's say the Soviet Union in the 1970s and early 80s, really didn't have much of an ideology at all. The closest any of them could come was so-called Soviet patriotism. Under the surface, you saw a Russian patriotism or an East Ukrainian patriotism, but that was not explicit yet. Eurasianism was coming into its own as a mainstream ideology. One of the reasons that the Jews wildly separated, almost violently separated, pulled out of the Soviet Union in the 1970s is that the money was gone. The value was gone. And given the wars between Israel and Syria, the Soviets were not on the Zionist side. Yes, they helped create Israel decades ago, but they weren't on the same side anymore. So for all those reasons, Jews, you remember the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, for the first time ever, they were going to put sanctions on Russia, but only, but that wouldn't happen if they let the Jews, Russian Jews, or Russian Jews, Soviet Jews immigrate to Israel. And from, say, 1970 to 1995, you had this huge exodus. And you don't have many Jews left in Russia. I think they're 0.02% of the population now, something like that. And that's very significant here. And I said back then, now I'm not going to just read from that 2015 paper, but I'm going to use it as a foundation. I of course, updated it. The American academic literature, I'm not even talking about the journalists, on Ukraine since the end of the so-called Cold War is a utter disaster. Back then, I did a quick search on Google Scholar, and there is nothing that diverged from the official State Department line or the line of the corporate NGOs and every major media outlet, no matter what their ideological background. On page one in 2015, it said, there was these are titles, President Yanukovych's growing authoritarianism. Another one was toward Sultanism, Yanukovych style. And then there were several articles speculating about the former president's net worth. That's just on page one of the results. And it doesn't matter in this case whether the writers were specialists in the area or not, because specialists or otherwise, they all said the same thing. I never understood this. I never understood what is the point of working so hard. And I certainly know what that's about. To get your doctoral degree, political philosophy, history, only to go to a university and say what everyone else is saying. Why become a scholar if that's all you're going to do? Why become a journalist if you're just going to be repeating things? Why be an echo? There's a Polish journal that I quoted back then. It's the Matuszak paper from 2013. I'm going to quote it. And this is actually a very tame quote from that journal. It says, Viktor Yanukovych, who won the presidential election in February 2010, quickly consolidated all political power under the Party of Regions, completely marginalizing the country's opposition forces. After amending the constitution and restoring a presidential system of government in Ukraine, Yanukovych took control of parliament and consequently became the country's most powerful political figure since independence. Now, they do go on to admit that both the president and the party had a substantial level of support in the country. But that comes afterward. Given what we know has happened in Ukraine since 2022, let alone 2014, this is one of these expressions, and I talk about this all the time now, of projection. What the regime really wants to do with their people, they'll condemn it with other people. It's almost like they can purge that immorality to the extent that they can feel immorality. But even now, I did another one of these just today. The same wild accusations they made about Putin, they make about him. He's a multi-billionaire. He lives in luxury. And they're condemning him for that, knowing full well how the current Jewish administrator of Kiev actually does have all of that, does have multiple mansions. And these kind of statements, it sounds awkward because it sounds like an editor made them put that in there or to reword it. Now, who publishes this journal, by the way? It says that they provide independent research, but then they also say that the journal is financed entirely by the Polish state budget, seemingly with absolutely no self-awareness. State-controlled media is the only media in Ukraine, or fanatically pro-state media, either way, is the only ones that are permitted. Everything that in that quote they condemn Yanukovych for, which by the way he didn't do, is exactly what was on the agenda at the time. A short time later, when the revolution took over in 2014. You know, if you want more detail on this, I have a book called Ukrainian Nationalism. You can look it up on Amazon. And I go into greater detail here, though mostly it's a historical work. But I can't tell you how many times you've heard me say how heartbreaking the total dissolution of Ukraine is over the last, let's say, well, since the mid-90s. Ukrainian independence was a total and complete catastrophe without precedent. Because there's no war here. It's not like, or this extremely violent revolution that tears apart a country. It's nothing like that. The first, second, third world typology is, first world is the Western liberal capitalist societies. The second world was the industrialized, but on a very different, on very different terms. Second world was the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. The third world was pretty much anyone else, and the former colonies especially, and the fourth world for especially, I mean, oppressively poor countries. Viktor Yanukovych is far from a inspiring or theoretical man. He didn't express himself in terms of political theory. But because he was slightly more friendly to Russia than the other regime was, economic growth took off. When you're starting from zero, people like, you know, President Kuchma, Yanukovych, restored an order that, you know, especially when, you know, 75% of your imports and exports are coming from the East, not the West. The Orange Revolution of 2004, which was interrupted by Yanukovych 6 years later, and then he had to go, and we're going to talk about why that is. So a decade later, they made it impossible for the regime made it impossible for anyone to do what Yanukovych did. However weakly he did it, the constant and consistent collapse. I can't believe I saw in the Financial Times talking about Ukraine is going into a recession. Either the guy is a complete, absolute moron, or he just does what he's told. The numbers of Ukrainian collapse to the point where only the informal sector really matters is unprecedented. And the regime, of course, doesn't, they still use the old free market or command economy paradigm, so they can understand it. They don't have the vocabulary for it. But just in the second quarter of 2015, so a year after the takeover, the gross domestic product of Ukraine fell by almost 15%. And that's official. That's the State Statistics Service of Ukraine. Probably it's much higher, of course. The first quarter, 2015, again, very similar, 17.2%, not taking into consideration the seasonal factors. So even the government back then was forced to admit that since the Maidan of 2014, by early 2015, what was left of the economy was largely gone. Every time I read these statistics, I wonder, I said, how many eras of collapse can you have? Is it a desert? But even in 2016, the cabinet of ministers was predicting a fall in GDP 12%. And the IMF was the same. The European Bank for Reconstruction and Development said back then that in 2015, the gross domestic product will fall by about 10%. The World Bank says something like 8%. Without any conception that, wait a minute, this derives directly from the empowerment of the oligarchy that 2014 brought about. So even if they do know how absurd their, you know, dissonant, their cognitive dissonance of their opinions here, they know how to short circuit their reason. They never take that extra step. But it's heartbreaking because the potential in 1990-95, the Ukrainian potential was extraordinary. This moral degeneration, human ignorance, mental illness has taken hundreds of thousands and now millions of lives in this era. Ukraine, at least back then, has more citizens with advanced degrees per 1,000 people than any other country in the world. Now, I've said that before, but I don't think it's true anymore. She had everything going for it. Impressive natural resources, excellent ports, trading partners willing to buy her goods, although they're not to the west, they're to the east and the south, and so much of their economy, the eastern and central regions, come from Russia and China, especially Russia. Rather, instead of seeing that, a handful of bankers decided to strip the country for a quick profit in the name of progress and the free market. And then when there was no more money to pay back, they then built a multi-billion dollar military to do their bidding. Her social system was deliberately destroyed. The people impoverished and totally within the informal sector. Religion and heritage mocked on the altar of Jewish oligarchy. Last year, this Jewish president and ruling class has banned all political parties and the Orthodox Church. And as I said before, this is perfectly consistent with what the regime means by democracy. But I've been saying that for a long time. Remember, the present war, yes, it's about weakening Russia. That's certainly true. But it's equally about depopulating Ukraine. The rabbis have been very clear that both Eastern Slavic and Orthodox people, and the Ukrainians, it's the Cossacks, and the Russians, it's the Tsar, were the only ones for centuries who understood what the Jewish mind was. Now, I write here in 2015, and by the time the war came in 2022, I was proven, it was proven that I was underestimating it. Yanukovych is not a bad guy. He's considered personally good-hearted. He's seen as personally upright, morally speaking. He has no, as I said, philosophical background. He is nothing like Lukashenko with that kind of social nationalism. He's uninspiring, and I suppose the choices that were offered at the time in 2010, he was probably the best bet. He was probably the best choice out of all of them. But it's still a weak choice, given the fact that the very existence of the country was at stake. But compared to people who are now leading this war, or what's left of it, he was not amoral, he was not nihilistic. But sometimes what economists don't fully understand is that mass unemployment, humiliation on the global stage, the dissolution of the entire country's industry, with the exception of the East, of course, these have real-world consequences in a social and psychological sense. Ukraine, by the late 90s, it became a cliche over there. It's typified by a low level of social trust, even those in the same circles. Public morals, not just private ones, have collapsed entirely, along with everything else. You can't push amorality in one sector and somehow not expect it to take root in another sector. I quoted a poll from 2010 that political parties in Ukraine, political parties as an institution, are trusted by a maximum of 3% of the population. And it's very clear. They had no real platforms. They refused to talk about economics. You had some of the Eurasian parties in the East, you know, that were pretty good, but they weren't permitted to function. And as soon as they were elected, if they were elected at all, they did what they were told. You had the idealists, you know, the social nationalists, Eurasians, mixing an ethnic socialism with a Eurasian foreign policy. But of course, by now, and I quote from them quite a bit, but now, of course, they've been exiled and their property confiscated. There's a Ukrainian writer, Nikolai Shulga, who writes in Ukrainian. I was a bit sharper in Ukrainian than I am now. Very few Ukrainians, anywhere they go, take the EU or NATO seriously as options. So the so-called revolt for westernization was not only a fake, but absurd. But Shulga tells us something. And he talks about the development of the oligarchy, the ruling class in Ukraine, starting from the very end of the Cold War. And he has 5 points. The first one is that as the Soviet Union collapsed into history, there was a certain coexistence between the old dissidents and the old Soviet elite. They tolerated each other. They may have been able to use each other. Starting roughly in 1995, this is number two, you started to have three centers of power, and this will, they'll collapse into each other. The economic oligarchy, very Jewish, the criminal gangs, very Jewish, and the new bureaucrats appointed to run the political offices. So there's a clan system of oligarchy, but that clan is ethnically based. That had both a regional and an ethnic, that is, Jewish coloring. And so much, or so many of them, if not almost all of them, have tremendous assets in the U.S. and in Israel if they ever needed to run away quickly. So up until, or by 2004, let's say from 1997 to 2004, these three power centers merged with each other. The older dissident groups, the anti-Soviet groups, were long gone. And starting in 2004, actual dissidents were removed from public life. And this is what the Orange Revolution was, number four. It institutionalized a rent-seeking ruling class, and any business that wasn't well-connected or large became absorbed into the system, using debt as a weapon. Now, unfortunately, this is the last one, number five, the era of Yanukovych as president was one of ideological stagnation. No new ideas or new recruits were brought into the political system. And this is one of the reasons why, and the total collapse of social trust, this is how the state, politics, legality, economics all collapsed into a single oligarchy, a single profoundly corrupt ruling class. And I say profoundly corrupt, I mean that it became, you know, you look at you funny if you didn't do corrupt things. It was so normal, and you can't function unless you do that. Any growth in state power, and this is something that did happen under Yanukovych, mildly irritated the Jewish oligarchs. But if there was any change at all, it was something like that. In 2010, when Yanukovych was elected, official statistics from Kiev put the poverty rate at about 40%. And maybe more than 50 out in the countryside. And certainly it's been, gotten far worse since then. I want to quote Shulga again, and this is from his book from 2011. Developing against this liberal background is a moral degradation of society. This degradation has become widespread and permeates all social strata. Morals of convenience and few moral rules governing interpersonal relations is the most widespread problem. Abnormal, deviant behavior has become a daily norm for huge masses of people. The unfortunate foundation for modern Ukrainian society is that of a man without ideology or morality, an abstraction, a man without attributes. Over two decades, this has created the total moral liquidation and rendered Ukraine a permanently sick society. And Shulga is extremely profound in this regard. But the conclusions that you take from this are fairly obvious. No one believes in Western liberalism. In fact, no one really believes in anything. Oligarchy and that level of tyranny through debt is normal. Property is highly conditional. It's as if mafia clans were to get together and divide up society amongst them. And the collapse of both the USSR and the Ukrainian economy from the 90s on destroyed anything, including ethnic bonding. The only ethnic bond is Jewish. This social transformation was violently revolutionary. It created a deformed state and, of course, destroyed the potential of this very large nation. The old style colonialism from the 19th century was very mild compared to what the West installed in Kiev. Oligarchy destroys social protections. There's no conception of the common good whatsoever, and no one has hope for the future. And it's gotten worse since Shulga wrote and since I wrote. Yanukovych sought a counter-revolution, but selling it was very difficult. And it was piecemeal, and it's not something that, you could put into a manifesto and get everyone all excited. Regardless of his plans, it had a very small chance of success. As I've said before, when you try to fight corruption, the implication is that there's non-corrupt areas of the state that you can then mobilize to fight the corrupt elements. Well, that's not the case here, at least as far as the state is concerned. Well, the first decree of Yanukovych when he was elected was to reduce the staff and maintenance of the presidential secretariat by about 20%. And when he was overthrown, of course, all of that was brought back. Two-thirds of all ministries of the central government were disbanded because there was no way to reform them. He created a National Anti-Corruption Committee, which he chaired personally, and he also created a reform committee dedicated to economic change in this regard, but he didn't want Ukraine to go back to Russia. Two languages, Ukrainian in particular, but Russian too, the official languages of the country. Ukrainian, of course, is going to be biased towards it. He issued a decree on the establishment of the Council of Regions as an advisory body to the president to ensure the proper interaction of Kiev with local government. Putin did the same thing when he shut down the direct elections to regional governments. Instead, they're chosen by the state legislatures. And, of course, it's one of the reasons that the prosperity came back in certain places. Putin knew, that the oligarchs have, the mafia, that was their power base, the regional level. Now, he also, and this is odd, but he reduced the number of companies and enterprises controlled by the state. Only those in areas of great strategic value remain state-controlled or even state-owned. Now, of course, since 2014, they've all been sold off, privatized to Western investors. Yanukovych, however, sold off the other companies because, or at least in part, because he tried to break the back of the oligarchs. That was a link between capital and the state. He wanted to pay debt too, I have no doubt. But one of the reasons that Ukraine was forced into this war against Russia was that there's no more money. This is how they're repaying debt, by blood. It was considered counter-revolutionary for him to decree that all public acts and all laws are to be totally transparent and available to the public in both Russian and Ukrainian. This was condemned vehemently by Washington. Yulia Tymoshenko, who I used to talk about all the time, I don't talk about her much anymore. This was opposed to European democracy, she said. By deregulating these sectors, he thought he was going to sever the links between oligarchy and the state. He even wanted to abolish conscription, which is something Washington would not allow him to do. Removing corruption and tax collection, which was a very early policy in Putin in 2001. Cutting them out of the energy sector. It was a huge agenda, and Yanukovych didn't have the presence to bring this about. His intentions were decent, but he was always compromising. I don't think he had a choice. He was in a much weaker position than Putin was in 2000, 2001. The moment the revolutionaries took over, and by the way, this was only in Kiev. You don't have these violent Maidan protests anywhere else. It was just in the capital city. The revolutionaries repealed everything. They repealed all anti-corruption measures and radically increased taxation. You did have economic growth, though, between 2006 and 2009, roughly about 5% a year. That same growth rate persisted. I'm sorry, it didn't persist. It then returned in 2010, 2012. It was between 2009 and 2010 that it began to bottom out. So, as I said, the year after the revolution, 2014, a full 20% of the economy was destroyed. When abroad, it was completely liquidated. Even as far back as 1998, the IMF says that real wages in 1998 had fallen by more than 75% in relation to their 1991 level. And of course, inflation was out of control, so that gets even worse. Now, the official unemployment statistics had it at about 20%, but it's hard to trust them. This is one place where the IMF may be a better place to go. The real figure, and this is in his speech, actually, the 13th Congress of the Party of Regions in 2012, he said it's probably along the lines of 50%, which, by the way, was also the inflation rate. And he quoted the State Statistical Service of Ukraine. And I found it at that service in 2015, but he had uttered this in 2012. After the revolution, industrial production declined by 23%. Now it doesn't exist. 10 years ago, new construction had fallen by 40%. All domestic banks were in bankruptcy. Now, of course, they're controlled by BlackRock. Exports went down 23%. Imports were down by 30% in that same short period of time. In 2011, though, you had a growth about 30% faster than the global rate. Investment did increase, but this had to do with the fact that Russians and Chinese felt more secure about the whole thing. In his 2012 speech, he said economic growth had increased by 6%, 22% increase in fixed capital investment. And so many of these high-value industries came from Russia. He actually mentions the engineering growth. But you average all of this out from 2004 to 2015, to be very, very generous, you saw a decline of 25% in GDP. I've said this before, but even without the war, which has been over for quite some time now, Ukraine would be in the exact same economic position. When Leonid Kuchma was president, there was economic growth because he had plenty of contacts in Russia, because he was an old-style Soviet type. In the 1990s, Ukraine lost 70% of its GDP, which meant that its exports had moved to raw materials, not finished goods. 11 million jobs were lost, and they have not been replaced. The ratio between the rich and the poor, just using the GDP figures, is 74 to 1. But that also is identical to the difference between Jewish income and Ukrainian income. How anyone could think, knowing full well who's responsible for this, the so-called Western vector, could riot to get it reinstalled in 2014 is laughable. Collapse in even the lifespan. Population decline. This is not a matter of efficiency. But that's the language that they used. It was a form of genocide. It turned Ukrainians against the West, at least in the political and economic areas. The only place that had, and this is one of the reasons why you did have economic growth in these areas, was Eastern Ukraine. His move to the East, the customs union with Russia, Central Asia, and he made it clear in 2013 that, yes, we have economic growth now, but this increase in Ukrainian exports were almost exclusively to the East. Exports to China went from 8% to about 10% in less than a year. Same thing for India. Chinese and Russian investment were very important. But given the nature of the political instability, when you go from one regime to another, no long-term kind of investment decision is ever going to be made. The Communist Party in Ukraine, at least back then, this is 2012, was really a Eurasian social nationalist party. They still like Lenin and all that. I don't know how they justify that, but I've spoken about this before. Peter Simonenko, I'm going to quote him here in 2012. As to whether the opposition leader, Yulia Tymoshenko bloc, our Ukraine, is in any way in opposition, it is not. It is a faction struggling for power. All their interests are confined to providing for their business clan's control over property. Upon becoming president herself, Tymoshenko held to exactly the same policy as her opponents. It is due to her and her associates that Ukraine was dragged into the IMF and WTO more intimately, bringing the economy in our country to the brink of collapse, and of course, total collapse. I've quoted Simonenko many times. There's really no relationship between policy, presidential power, political theory, and the economy. And I don't necessarily want to blame growth on people like Kuchma as a personal matter. But to deliberately turn away from the East would destroy the economy. And of course, that's exactly what happened. Now, anyone who even weakly follows Ukrainian political parties when they existed, no one could possibly say they had ideals of any kind. They were spokesmen for far more powerful interests. And politicians don't really call the shots. Now, if we applied that to our Western systems, we may get some improvement. But even academics were taking the American party system and assuming that that's how it was in Ukraine. Now, of course, it's far worse. And we live in institutionalized corruption. But that's what the kids call chaotic evil. We have lawful evil. But you did have some mild improvement under Yanukovych, and that's purely an Eastern phenomenon. But from 2014-15 to today, it has been one long liquidation. Between 89 and 95, let's be clear, 80% of the economy was liquidated. So any growth really comes from a position of a vacuum. And it's not a matter of systematic control. It is based on human choice and the ethnic domination. when all this first started, both in 2004 when I had my old website and 2014, the entire westernization or EU faction of Ukrainian capital made me laugh. And this is what the media, with no exceptions, by the way, even the ideological media in the West, including the leftists, they just assumed that the EU vector was the only one. And I said, there are no products that Ukraine makes that Europe can't make themselves. And from 2008 to now, the EU and the US can't absorb its production today as it is, let alone import from Ukraine. I also cited the Bulgarian example. Bulgarians were brought into the EU against all the rules of governing entry into it. They were brought into this club for one reason, and that was to keep them from any alliance with Russia in the customs union. Bulgaria would actually have an economy if they had gone east rather than west. Nothing about their economy then suggested that they had passed any of the EU's fairly stringent financial and economic standards and failed all of them. And in that period of time, the population fell from 9 million to 7 million. The Jewish mafia, people like Mogilevich, are still very powerful there. And it continues to fall. I'm talking about the Copenhagen criteria. And this is what the EU says about that. So anyone talks about coming into the EU, this is what they're supposed to be like. Membership requires that candidate country has received stability of institutions guaranteeing democracy, the rule of law, human rights, respect for and protection of minorities, the existence of a functioning market economy, as well as a capacity to cope with competitive pressure and market forces from within the union. Membership presupposes the candidate country's ability to take on the obligation of membership, including adherence to the aims of political, economic, and monetary union. Actually, this doesn't apply to most countries in the EU today, but certainly it didn't apply to Romania or Bulgaria. And they want to bring Ukraine. Can you imagine bringing Ukraine into the... How do they rationalize this? They don't care about the... it would simply be a way to continue to extract resources of Ukrainian labor to the banks. In order to be a part of the EU, actually it's quite strict. Inflation has to be brought totally under control. Public debt can be no more than 60% of GDP. Interest rates can be no more than 2% higher than the bottom three EU member countries. And a budget deficit can't be any more than 3% of GDP. Ukraine, Bulgaria, Romania, they're nowhere near this. The unemployment in Ukraine and Bulgaria back then is about the same, between 30 and 50%. Corruption ruling all levels of society, to understate it. But no one denies this today. Bulgaria lost everything. They're just a raw materials exporter by now. They were an oil-producing country. They had a lot of potential, too. That was taken over by Western investors. They brought in nuclear power, despite being self-sufficient in energy, and that was taken over. These countries have an industrial foundation that is long gone. And Ukraine is no different. It's a third-world country, fourth-world country today, that has nothing to offer the EU. But taking them in, same thing goes. NATO's conditions are very strict too, militarily and economically. They have to be liberal societies in all senses of that term. But the point is, for Bulgaria and Ukraine and to a lesser extent Romania, keeping them away from the customs union. So again, there's no principles here. There's really no criterion here. Kiev has nothing Europe wants. And when it had an industrial economy, and of course you do still have some of that in the east, although much of it has been destroyed, it's being rebuilt. Everything was aimed towards the east, not consumers in the west. Well, there's not enough production. It's absurd to think that Ukraine can ever remotely meet the EU standards for all of this. But let me shift gears here. In 2011, I said he was not a theoretical mind. He didn't have a theoretical mind. And like so many politicians of the old Soviet era, they have very vague conceptions of what principles are. Here's what he wrote in 2011. An effective system of state governance must be based on three fundamental assumptions. First, national traditions and culture, the rule of law, and from that, democratic practices that soon permeate society and form the basis of democratic legitimacy. Actually, this is the Republican idea, the nation focused on the common good, which can be made real with the gradual modernization of society. Second, along with the economic transformation, the necessary constitutional and legal, the broad context, democratic modernization must all be based on the nation. This is the foundation upon which we can bring the legislative and regulatory framework of Ukraine into accord with European standards. Finally, democratic reform is a clear break with the USSR and how it ran society. This is part of the war on corruption and the cynical use of political populism. That's about as theoretical as Yanukovych ever got. But because these are very vague and very general, this is one of the reasons I wrote this paper in the first place. You have to know how to read it. National traditions and culture. This is Orthodox Ukraine. This is the Cossacks. The common good, which is the opposite of a regime dedicated to usury controlled by foreigners. When he talks about modernization, he's talking about strategic sectors that can be used to protect independence. Everything has to be based on the nation. He didn't say the state. We know what he's talking about. And if this doesn't meet European standards, well, so what? He knew he was vulnerable. And so he went on about, we can do both. We could work towards EU and be a part of the customs union. And we all know what the EU's answer to that was. While he came of age in the USSR, in no way did he believe that it was worth maintaining. Certainly it was better than what happened in the 90s. But democracy for him is the opposite of, you know, Soviet policy. And when he talks about political populism, he's not talking about how it's used in the West as really synonymous with nationalism. No, that's when someone like Yulia Tymoshenko or Poroshenko, any of these people, pretend that their agenda is even remotely connected to the common good. But this is a classically National Socialist conception. It's common sense. Any order can't exist without a firm nationalist basis. But the EU could never accept this. He had to have known that. In the EU and the US, law doesn't come from national tradition. Remember, the nation tradition comes before the state. Rationalism in the West simply means that law comes from the interest of finance capital. He defines national independence as, quote, primarily a state's ability to freely choose their own development path, to protect the interests of its citizens adequately, and to meet the challenges of the modern changing world. Well, the U.S. and the EU, the entire regime is based on a single democratic capitalist conception of development. That's the entire thing. I'm going to quote him again. This is from 2012. He says, and we're talking about foreign trade here, the politicization of foreign trade and Ukrainian-Russian economic relation in general threatens trade and cooperation ties, bilateral investments, ones that attack existing technology and production chains. In turn, this will provoke rejection of joint modernization and production plans to enter the high-tech and innovative markets of third countries. An important component of relations with the economic sphere is to optimize conditions for gas and oil contacts concluded with the Russian side. Today, the central point of negotiations is to review the current contract from 2009, including changes in the pricing formula of imported Russian gas. From the definition of the baseline, it depends on a number of competitive sectors of Ukrainian industry. You know, he writes like a Soviet bureaucrat. I mean, you know, he used a lot of words to say something fairly simple. Now remember, we're not just talking about oil and gas. It's about 10% of the Russian economy. Everything that Ukraine used to make was being bought to the east. Now there certainly is no slavishly pro-Russian view here. Like a good nationalist leader, his foreign policy is balanced. Lukashenko is the same way. But let me clarify this. As all this was going on, 2004, 2014, I said it back then, and let me summarize it now. It's in 5 points. Part of the collapse of Ukraine, if not a huge portion of it, comes from their turning away from the East. This is why only the East, the customs union, etc., can provide any modicum of prosperity. Number one, the Ukrainian economy in the Soviet era was designed specifically for the oil union world. Yes, it certainly had to be modernized, but the massive expense to shift this, and for no good reason, is prohibitive. Number two, as I've already said, there's no market for Ukrainian goods in the West. They could barely market their own elsewhere. The West can barely, they're always overproducing. Number three, there is little cultural or linguistic unity with the West. Among Americans, Ukraine, like Russia, is this blank spot on their consciousness, even amongst intellectuals. If Russia is, then Ukraine certainly is. Ukrainian goods are in demand in Central Asia, China, and Russia. And of course, as I wrote this and it continues, the Eastern economies are growing substantially. The EU has had its day, assuming it ever had its day. It could never get out of debt stagnation. Russia hasn't had debt in a decade and a half. They have short-term debt, but that's normal. And in fact, the sanctions were laughable. And as I said many years ago, at least during the Obama administration, I said, all this is going to do is increase the institutional connections between the East, the SCO, you know, China, Central Asia, Iran, and now parts of the Middle East, especially now, with Russia. Russia is a fully self-sufficient economy if they really needed to be. Well, he did say this and expressed this in 2012. But as he said, and as I said, you know, all those years ago, the so-called government of Ukraine reports to the U.S. ambassador every week. All government appointments have to go through the ambassador's office. Now, back then, this is in actually 2015, this comes from the social nationalist bloc, the Vitrenko bloc. But they're quoting a member of Poroshenko's party. The cabinet and parliament are increasingly saying that any possible change in the ranks of the country's leaders has to be negotiated with the U.S. Embassy. In America, we have seen the parameters of political appointments beyond which we can't go. We understand that those who have promised to privatize all assets the Americans want, such as Finance Minister Natalia Yaritsko, Minister of the Economy Abramovicius, Minister of AIC Pavlenko, and Transport Minister Pivovarsky, do what they're told, and the Americans do not hide their happiness. I love the Petrenko website. I used to be on it all the time. Of course, it doesn't exist anymore. It's been banned, and I guess they're all living in exile, at best. Now, I was talking about this in 2004, but this is coming from one of Poroshenko's people. You imagine being so naive that you think this was about independence? What happened in Kosovo? Quote-unquote independence was sold to the population, but the entire purpose was to make it a ward of the EU. It's governed entirely by bureaucrats appointed from Brussels. Yanukovych also, in 2012, spoke about the importance of China. And he's talking about this relative to the high-tech opportunity that China can bring. Russia is probably ahead in that respect. But China has an active investment policy in many regions of the world and has expressed interest in Ukraine's economy. Of course, not anymore. Although they do have an interest in Crimea. He says the qualitative change in political relations with China made it possible to reach agreements on a number of mutual projects jointly implemented by the Chinese and Ukrainian companies in Ukraine. According to preliminary estimates, the cost of contracts concluded in 2010-2011 was about $6 billion American dollars. Well, when Western Capital heard that in his 2012 address, they took it, and they were probably right. It means that the Russia, Armenia, China, Burma, Syria axis of resistance now had a new member. I should have said Iran there too, and much of Central Asia. In his election platform for 2007, he wanted to raise the minimum wage. He wanted free trade with the EU, but avoid NATO entirely. And it wasn't like he opposed EU trade. He just realized what all normal people realize, that no one really cares about Ukrainian goods, except that which has long since been established in the Russian market. How else did he offend the Americans and the regime? He said this. This is the same 2012 speech. He said, Ukraine actively advocates the revitalization and development of trade and economic cooperation within the CIS on the basis of sovereign partnership, equality, and mutual benefit. One of the important priorities of cooperation with CIS countries, Ukraine considers the energy sector, where joint coordinated action of states concerned should ensure sustainable and reliable energy supplies in CIS countries, creating the conditions for the formation of effective functional cooperation. And according to the State Statistical Service of Ukraine, Ukrainian exports to the former Soviet Union are more than 30% of all commodity production. The services are over 60%, and imports 40%. In 2011, compared with 2010, Ukrainian exports to the CIS countries increased more than 33%, and imports by almost 40%. This was just one other thing that led the regime to realize that Yanukovych had to go. What do Americans care where Kiev goes, where it's oriented with its foreign trade? Well, the oligarchs, financial, energy elite, live and breathe this issue. But what's completely unmistakable, and it's absurdly proven without question, that whenever your trade is oriented with the West, the growth of Ukraine falls because capitalism is usury, and usury now is essentially asset stripping. But he also said, well, maybe Kazakhstan, Russia, the customs union, they might not be always reliable partners. Playing one off against another, that's classic nationalism, especially with a smaller country. He wanted them to compete to give Kiev the best deal. But that common sense is a fond memory. Now Ukraine doesn't have the power to do anything. They barely have the power to take orders, let alone give them. He rejected the idea that an alliance with one automatically meant the exclusion of the other. But since the regime is purely black and white, which is another psychological issue, purely black and white, there is no such thing as a compromise. You either let us take over your country, or you're a Kremlin stooge. And this is how academics and journalists state it. Maybe they're that stupid, but maybe they just know where their money is coming from. Yanukovych made a terrible error. He saw lucrative contacts with Shell and Chevron to tear up the eastern and western sides of the country with shale fracking. We know what fracking is, the total disregard for natural resources, and certainly from a foreign firm. He did collect a commission from that. So this is, I am not romanticizing this man at all. Of course, that's nothing compared to what's happening now. He saw it as a temporary measure to survive. My God, this is a country that survived Polish and Jewish colonialism for centuries. Invasions from Turks and Tartars, Soviet starvation policies, tens of millions of deaths, gulags, dozens of genocide attempts, German invasion, Cold War. But the minute it comes in contact with liberalism, over just two decades, the country's on the verge of extinction. Anyway, that's as far as I'm going to go today. Even if you're not as interested in this kind of thing as I am, this is a first-rate case study of how oligarchy works economically. You can't use market or command economy slogans here. Neither one of them are relevant anymore. My paper on the political economy of oligarchy on Patreon, that's where you go to see how we can predict the actions of oligarchs. You can't use the market. They don't follow the market. They create it. Well, Happy New Year, everybody. And I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.